Societally, we don't talk about death, we don't prepare for death, we don't prepare for end of life, we don't prepare for a broken arm, right? We don't prepare for cancer. But when we have those things, when those experiences come into our life, we seek experts. We seek people who are prepared for that to help guide us through that, to help mend our bones, to help cure our cancer, whatever the issue is. And hospice is no different.
When people come to us and they feel like they're giving up, they feel like they're letting down their family, they feel like they're letting down their physician, their family feels like they're letting down their loved ones, their physicians feel like they're letting down their patients, everybody feels like it's a failure. We have so much work to do just to get a basic foundation of stability that we lose the opportunity to really create that once-in-a-lifetime experience of this is your life. How do you want it to look right now?
Welcome to Living Healthy Together, where we're talking this week about hospice care, what individuals and families need to know to better prepare for the end-of-life journeys that will be part of their own story, and learning why perhaps the best thing any of us can do is reach out to an organization like Home Health and Hospice in Chittenden County to learn more about them and the services, supports, and insights they have to share. First, I'm going to welcome Lean Dirt Houseman, a Vermonter whose family navigated these experiences with support and care through Home Health and Hospice. Lean Dirt, thanks for joining us and sharing these intimate moments from your life. Start at the beginning. Tell me a little bit about how you and your wife met.
I have been living in the United States since 1973, more than half my life. And I have been living with my wife here in South Burlington since 1995. We have one son who is temporarily living with me here in South Burlington. And all my other family lives abroad in the Netherlands or New Zealand. My wife's name is Johanna. We met in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we got married 8 months after we had met. We lived in Massachusetts. We lived in New York State in Westchester County. And as I said before, we came to Vermont in 1995. She was a nurse, a registered nurse in the Netherlands. Her major thing in her life was arts and in particular music. And she was a member of several choruses, the Vermont Symphony Orchestra Chorus, the Vermont Choral Union. So she was very active in that way. And it was a big loss for her when a few years before she died, she basically lost her voice.
That must have been very difficult for both her and you.
It was very difficult. This was such an important part of her life. We kept on going to concerts, but she was very sad to be in the audience and not there on the podium and singing with the others.
Let's talk about when and how her medical journey began.
That started at the end of 2015. She had just a regular checkup. And the x-rays showed some minor tumors down in her belly. And that was very shocking, obviously. So we went to a specialist who examined her, and it turned out that she had endometrial cancer. We thought at the time, still very much in the beginning, so hopefully it could be operated upon. The operation happened a few months later, and the doctors could tell it was successful. But then at the end of 2016, early 2017, it came back. And then from there on, it just grew.
For our listeners out there, endometrial cancer is a uterine cancer. Was it diagnosed initially as an advanced cancer or did it progress?
I think it was called stage one. So not very well developed at all. And the hope was that a good operation would be able to cut off all the affected areas. It was checked at the lab and the margins were clear. So everybody thought it was a success, but clearly some cancer cells had escaped and had started to grow again in other places around the belly and the intestines and all the way up to the lungs. And of course, then it became more serious. They could see with x-rays and some other techniques where the tumors were. And at some point, they were going to go in and cut away some. So I asked, well, when you're there anyhow, just cut away everything. And they said, no, you can't. It's just too much of it.
When did you and Johanna start talking about end-of-life matters and really preparing for her passing?
She had been thinking about it. I had been thinking about it. But it was not something I was going to bring up. That's something that she had to decide on her own. I didn't want to push her in any direction whatsoever. So she brought it up and she asked me, why didn't you bring it up earlier? And I told her, that's not something I am going to bring up. I'm not going to tell you, oh, maybe you should think about ending your life. That has to come from you. But now that you have brought it up, I will support you whichever direction you want to go. And I could totally understand, because that was a period in which you really was suffering this pain and was getting very depressed. Life was just very unpleasant for her. So we did start at the end of 2020 on the process of doctor-assisted suicide. But then she seemed to be getting better, so she sort of dropped it. And then eventually in April 2021, it became unavoidable. The bleeding started again, and that's when she basically gave up. And I knew, well, this is it. If it had seemed that she would still be able to stay alive, I would at that point have advised her doctor-assisted suicide. We didn't have to, because she died the next day.
Reflecting on that time, what are the things that you treasure most from those days?
The final days, the things I treasure is that I was able to help her. I was able to be there with her, listen to her. My wife comes from a very talkative family, and I do not. So that occasionally caused some friction. And looking back, I wish I had talked more. But at the end, things went so fast. When she went to the respite house, my son, who is in the National Guard, went out on duty somewhere. And I had to call him and tell him, you have to come here right this moment. And fortunately, his commander understood, so he could come over right away. For both of us, it was so shocking. Not that she died, because both of us knew that this is the end, but that it was so precipitous, so quick, that we barely had time to prepare ourselves for it.
Talk about the decision to choose the respite house. What did that process look like?
I probably will never forget what happened. I was downstairs preparing breakfast, and I was going to go upstairs to bring her some to see if she needed any help getting up. And she was clearly distressed, and it turned out that she had started bleeding again. And at that moment, she just gave up. She had no idea what to do anymore. I had prepared myself enough to know that, well, this is the moment to call Home Health Hospice. So I called them. They had already visited her several months ago. So a nurse would come over right away. In about 20 minutes, she was at the front door. And she talked to my wife, and she told us, we have two choices. One is the emergency room, and the other one is the respite house, because this is not something you can handle alone in your house. And we had already decided that no more emergency rooms. So the decision was clear. Go to the respite house. And the nurse was very helpful. She called an ambulance. The ambulance came and picked her up and brought her to the respite house. So it was all very deliberate. It was like following a plan. We had talked about it enough to know, is the only option.
What advice do you have for folks listening right now who may be dealing with this in their life or think they're going to be soon? How can they approach these conversations?
First of all, you can never talk about it enough. That's something I have learned since she died, and I realized looking back at all the things she did, the things she said, all the things I did, that I should have talked about this. I should have talked about that. It's never enough. And the sooner you start doing it, the better it is. When the moment came, the 1 or 2 days before she died, we both knew what was going to happen. We both knew what needed to be done. There was no, shall we not? How do you feel? Are you ready to go? The respite house is the best solution. And we got so much support there. And it made last 24 hours of her life so much more comfortable, even though she was in great discomfort, to know that I was there, my son was there, and there were very competent nurses there who could help her. And at least, I hope it alleviated her anxiety a lot. I didn't wrestle with it because before my wife went there, there were two other friends who ended up in the respite house. So I was familiar with it. I knew what happened there. I knew how people were taken care of. And I realized this is actually a fantastic idea because sometimes people, when they are dying, really need medical care. Things are falling apart. And how do you handle that? And the emergency room is just not the right place for that. The nurses there were fantastic. The way they handled it. I was there when she died and we were trying to talk, but she had too many pain medicine that she was a little bit out of it, but we still tried to communicate. And at some point she had a reaction and I asked her, are you bleeding again? And she just nodded. So I got a nurse and it was just wonderful to see how concerned they were and how comforting they were when they stayed with her. And they managed to stop the bleeding. They finally got her to sort of relax a little bit. And then she fell asleep. And she was sort of in of it, out of it, and then she died. That is not something that anybody can give your spouse, your child, your loved one, or anybody else who is not trained to do that. I could not have done that.
I think part of what you're talking about here is dignity. It's all so beyond your control after a certain point. How do you manage to find dignity for your wife and for yourself throughout this?
I think the central part of that is that the medical people there, the nurses, but also the administrative staff, treat you with dignity. For my wife to feel that these nurses take my situation seriously. They're not trying to wave it off as, oh, you're just overdoing it. It's not that bad. Or any of the other bromides. They knew what she was going through. They conveyed to her, we know what you are going through. And we will do our best to make things as comfortable as we possibly can. I think that's where the dignity comes in. That until the very end, my wife was treated like a real living human being.
Lean Dirt, thank you for sharing your memories. These are among the most intimate moments any of us will ever experience in our lives, and I'm really grateful for your insights and that you shared some of Johanna's story with us. We're going to take a quick break. When Living Healthy Together returns, we'll sit down with the Director of Hospice and Palliative Care at Home Health and Hospice and learn more about the care and support available to individuals and families dealing with death, dying, and end-of-life concerns. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're talking about hospice care, at-home care, and end-of-life concerns and what you and your family need to know and need to be thinking about to make that process smooth dignified, and, though you might not believe it, rewarding. We're joined now by Annie Meredith Mitchell, the Program Director of Hospice and Palliative Care at Home Health and Hospice. Annie, thank you so much for joining us. What I keep hearing from folks, both on the show and off it, is that this is really impactful care and support that's out there for folks, and yet a disturbingly low number of people actually engage with it and get the benefits from it. So talk about what this care and support is, and then why aren't people engaging with it in a way that could prove beneficial for them?
Hospice is holistic or biopsychosocial care of a person who is dying and their loved ones. If we put that into easier terms to imagine, hospice is a type of medical care that's highly specialized, skilled, and really focuses on a person who is experiencing a serious illness and the impact of that serious illness as they approach the end of their life. And what are those impacts on all aspects of their life? How are they feeling physically in their body? How are they feeling emotionally? How are they feeling spiritually? What grief are they anticipating? What support does their family need? And we come in when somebody chooses hospice with nurses and social workers, chaplains, volunteers, hospice aides, a doctor, and we're able to make connections with a patient and a family and really focus on what are those individual experiences that you're having. You're going through a once-in-a-lifetime experience. We're all going to die someday, but everybody's journey is unique. And it's a once-in-a-lifetime chance to really say, this is the most important thing to me right now, and how can I make that a reality? Is it the alleviation of a particular physical symptom? Like, I'm physically uncomfortable right now, and I really wish that this pain in my hip would go away. Is it the desire to reconnect with a family member from whom you've been estranged? I can talk to my hospice social worker or my chaplain and say, I haven't spoken to somebody in my family in years, and I really want to connect with them and tell them what's going on. They can help me make that happen. Is it a practical concern? Do I have family members who I'm worried about? What's going to happen after I'm no longer here? I can help plan to make sure that they are cared for and supported even after my death. It is emergency care. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't quite know what to do. Maybe my husband is the hospice patient and I'm really nervous because he seems uncomfortable or like he's having difficulty breathing. Hospice is a phone number that I can call at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I can not only get a nurse who knows my husband on the phone, I can get somebody to come out to my house and help me take care of him. It is a wraparound 24-hour-a-day, holistic, whole person, whole family, specialized healthcare benefit that everybody in this country, when they are dying, is clinically entitled to. And in general, less than half of the people who have access to hospice service actually receive it. So when you ask me why such a rich and robust benefit isn't accessed, all I can say is I think people don't realize. I think that most people believe hospice is something for those last couple weeks of life, or something that you can only access or should only access when you've tried every other single thing out there to try and there's, quote, nothing left to do. People sometimes think hospice means giving up. And I prefer to think of hospice as a type of care that really focuses on making the absolute most of life, regardless of how much life you have left. So, biggest barrier, I believe people are afraid. They're afraid that if they choose hospice, it means they've given up. When in reality, the earlier they choose hospice, the better they can live.
You talked a bit about misconceptions and fear. Are there other misconceptions that are important for us to kind of set up and knock down for folks here?
I think the biggest misperception that people may have is that they're not ready, that there's still more treatment that can help, so it's not time for hospice yet. And they may not realize that they have the right to make the choice to pursue hospice, which is palliative, comfort-based, person and family-based care, goal-driven, even if there are still treatment options available to them, if the benefits of hospice outweigh the burden of that treatment and it's aligned with their philosophical goals and values. So I think people feel sometimes that, like I said, they need to wait until the last possible minute because they will get better care that way or even live longer that way. When in fact, we even have studies that demonstrate that choosing hospice sooner might actually result in longer lifespan. So that's a huge misconception. I think that the other things that have a tendency to come up from time to time are things like, oh, that's just for people with cancer. That's not true. Any diagnosis that's expected to limit a person's lifespan could make a person eligible for hospice. People sometimes believe that's just for people who are older. The majority of folks who receive hospice care are elderly. However, we can see if we look at statistics that the younger you are when you die, the less likely you are to have hospice. And it's not because you're not eligible for hospice. It's because people don't think about it when they're younger. But there's no age limit either on the upper or the lower end of the spectrum. Another misconception is I think many people feel like they need to wait for their doctor to say something, whether that's the specialist, the oncologist, the cardiologist, or the PCP. I think many times when we hear from an individual, a family member who picks up the phone and calls our office, says, hey, I have some questions, we very quickly can respond by providing the information that they're asking about and then reaching out to the physician themselves and say, hey, you know what? Bob called. He's interested in hospice. Would you mind if we went out to the house and talked with him? And that's oftentimes how hospice can get started. People don't need to wait for their doctor to say something. This is care that they're empowered to seek all by themselves, and we support that.
For most of healthcare, death is a failure. That's not the way this works at this stage of the game or at this stage of thing. So what's it like being a healthcare professional in a system that probably still doesn't quite get it? Even though it's the system, it still doesn't quite get it in much the same way that patients and families and individuals don't quite get it.
And it's not just the system, it's our society. We are in a death-denying society, so death is a failure. It's particularly a failure of healthcare. Hospice is probably the only healthcare modality in which death is not considered a poor outcome. I think the biggest impact is that people usually come to hospice far too late for us to do the work that we are known for. When I talk about the positive outcomes associated with hospice, reconnecting with family, management of pain and other physical symptoms, living that bucket list because you're well supported and you have the equipment and the team in place to help support you with that wish list, doing that takes time. And if people are spending their last 12 months, 6 months, 3 months, 2 months pursuing treatments that are trying to prevent death, we lose the opportunity to create that once-in-a-lifetime experience of, hey, this is the last chance you're going to have to get to go skydiving or the last trip to Maine that you're going to take. Right? These are the things that we live for and we live to help people create. Those healthcare outcomes, the really good hospice outcomes where people talk about the relationships that they had, how well their symptoms were managed, how grateful they were for hospice, that occurs when people receive their hospice care for 2 or 3 months. We, in general, find that our median length of stay for how long people are on hospice before they die is about 27 days. So less than 1 month of hospice care. When people come to us and they are racked with symptoms, they feel like they're giving up. They feel like they're letting down their family. They feel like they're letting down their physician. Their family feels like they're letting down their loved ones. The physicians feel like they're letting down their patients. Everybody feels like it's a failure. We have so much work to do just to get a basic foundation of stability. Are you in general physically comfortable in your body? Are you prepared for the fact that your loved one is going to die? Do we have the right advanced directives in order? We lose the opportunity to really create that once-in-a-lifetime experience of this is your life. How do you want it to look right now? That's our specialty, and we wish we could do that. In general, when we talk about high-value healthcare, healthcare that provides positive outcomes where people feel good, patients and families feel supported and like, yep, I got the kind of care I wanted and I would do that again. That comes with having had hospice for a few months, not a few weeks. So, yeah, does a death-denying society and health system create tension and make it harder for us to do our job? It absolutely does. We do our best to do everything that we can. We would love to have more time to do it.
How has hospice developed over time? Are there opportunities coming up to make a change that you see as potentially really impactful?
One of the biggest changes that I've seen in my career is the amount of federal scrutiny that hospices are under. Over the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen a proliferation of hospices pop up all over the country. Many are owned by for-profit corporations, which does not necessarily mean that they're doing bad work at all. It's just kind of a trend that we're observing. And unfortunately, with some of these hospices, their practices are less scrupulous and occasionally fraudulent. So as a result, and I think this is actually a positive thing, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is paying a whole lot more attention to what hospices are doing and really forcing us to demonstrate that we are following our regulatory requirements. There's a website that was formed in the last 10 years called Hospice Compare. It's run by the federal government, and anybody who is interested in receiving hospice care should go to the Hospice Compare website, punch in their zip code, see which hospice care providers are providing care in their service area, and look at the family experience and quality ratings that that hospice has. If there's one thing that people take away from this, besides, hey, call hospice sooner, it's please, if you're thinking about hospice, do some research. You're entitled to pick your own hospice provider, not limited to Vermont, not limited to our service area at all, wherever you are. Take some time, do some research, and pick the hospice provider that has the quality and family experience ratings that you want your family or your loved one to receive.
Such an important resource. If you're listening to this as a podcast, that'll be linked in the episode description along with the home health and hospice information. So take a look at those resources. We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we're going to talk with a caregiver about her experience while one of her very good friends was going through the end of life. A hospice social worker and bereavement counselor about the support and care that they provided even after the end of life. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're joined now by IT Director and Epic Program Administrator Christy Brown, who currently works at Home Health and Hospice, but who's been a member of the UVM Health IT team since 2015. Christy, thanks for joining us today and sharing your story as a friend, family member, and caregiver of someone who has passed. Tell us about your friend, Anne, and how you two met. How did you become friends?
Thanks so much for having me here. My best friend, Anne, and I were assigned to each other by friends of ours. We both had living situations which were a bit untenable. She had a bad roommate, and I needed to get out of the living situation I was in. And so friends of ours conspired to make us roommates. And that happened back in, I think, 2006. So we became roommates and became thick as thieves, honestly, over the years. Best friends, lived together for a number of years, and so on. When I first met Anne, she was a couple of years out of an open heart surgery that she'd had in Cleveland Clinic when they kind of discovered the severity of her heart condition and knew if they could have, they would have given her a transplant then and there, but that just wasn't the circumstances. So by the time I met her, she was kind of queuing up to get a pacemaker installed. And so she wasn't you know, the skiing, outdoors, doing all kinds of activities person that she had once been. But she was also somebody who still was driving and working and living a life as best she could. But over the course of the years that we lived together, she did continue to decline and eventually did get to the point where she probably needed to consider a heart transplant. And when I met her, she was somebody who said, I don't really think I want to do that. Like, I think that's going to be a lot of work and I'm not sure I want to do that. But she was also in her 30s. And it was like, well, what else are you going to do? There's no alternative that seems good here. And so eventually she got to the point where it was very clear that her heart was failing. She was hospitalized in and out multiple times. She didn't always have people there because at that point, her father had passed away, her siblings live in New York, and she just had her friends and her friends here in Vermont that were her kind of chosen family. But she was very independent and would often be in Boston by herself and not really let us know. And so it was a tough road sometimes. And then in 2010, she got to the point where she needed to have medication intravenously to keep her alive until she might qualify for a heart transplant. I didn't live with her at that point. We weren't roommates anymore. And we arranged for friends to come and provide 24/7 care from June to August. And it changed in August because in August, she tried to get on the transplant list. Initially, they actually declined her because she had liver issues that they were concerned about. And they also felt that she didn't have the social support on paper that you usually need and would have to be successful with a transplant. And so when they told her no, that was probably like the challenge she needed to be like, actually, I want this. I don't want to die. And she met with them and pled her case and said, you don't understand. I have family, but they're just not related to me. And they have been caring for me 24/7 for the last 2 months. So she pled her case on a Tuesday. And on a Thursday, they said, all right, we're going to do this. We're going to list you. And on the following Tuesday, she got a call to say that a heart was available, that she was the only person on the list in New England that this heart would fit because it came from a 17-year-old boy and she was very small at that point. She had lost so much weight. And so she went down to Boston and had her heart transplant overnight. And that was kind of where things began for the next phase of her life.
Tell us a little bit about Anne and about the things that helped you two bond. It's not easy as an adult to make friends and to make connections. And it sounds like there was a really strong one here.
Anne was a fiercely independent person. When I met her, she had already been diagnosed with the heart condition that she was born with, but didn't really know about till she was in her 30s. Her mother had died at 38 from the same heart condition, and her brother had already had a heart transplant. Her independence was just like unmatched. She was somebody who wanted to be able to do everything by themselves regardless. And she was also a real adventurer and a very funny woman. And so we got along well in that we both just really enjoyed living and being independent and kind of out there and getting into trouble sometimes. She was somebody who you always knew you were going to have fun, might get into some sort of situations, but she had a great attitude. And she was also difficult because she was managing her health independently and just continually kind of pushing up against the system that was telling her what she needed to do to stay alive. And she just wanted to be a 30-something-year-old and enjoy her life. So it was tough. At the time, I actually had just gotten into healthcare IT and had previously been a healthcare provider. So it was kind of painful at times to watch someone who was bucking the system now and again. But I wasn't there to be her mom. I was eventually, you know, her best friend. And we just kind of rolled with it. And I tried to help where I could.
And that's something I didn't get into in the intro. You're also a physical therapist by training. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like having such a close friend and watching them go through these struggles when part of your core self is helping people recover?
It's a double-edged sword because you know enough to be dangerous sometimes. I knew enough on how to read things and understand the directions. And also I had this innate loyalty to both sides of the situation where, you know, wanting Anne to be as independent and self-directed as possible, but also watched her be an incredibly difficult patient at times and willful and not following direction. So it was not always an easy road. And we tried to navigate it in a way that was both like understandably kind and thoughtful to her, but also being honest about what it means when you don't follow the directions. It also was hard because I felt like the healthcare system is here to help people stay alive and independent, but at times it felt like it was also killing her. Not intentionally, but just it's a lot to go through organ transplant and post-organ transplant survival, and then making decisions around how you want your care to go.
How did things change for Anne and you after she transitioned to at-home hospice care and services?
I was over the course of a couple years or so where her health was declining. She had to move back east to be closer to her care. She started to have failing health in 2022. And at that point, her kidneys were failing. So she needed a kidney and a heart. And her health just continued to deteriorate. And her world got smaller and smaller. She requested to be removed from the transplant list. And that's where you start your journey into a different form of care. I had worked for home health and hospice 20 plus years ago, and I understood what happened. I knew the amazing kind of care that she would get. Hospice is a bridge. It's a mechanism to be cared for in the place that you want to be and help direct the end of your own life instead of being trapped in a hospital or being dictated by other things. Having been a caregiver in it and then been a family member of someone in it, I think it's magical.
We talk a lot about the person that is experiencing the medical challenge or the end of their life, and there's nothing wrong with that, but we tend to forget about the impacts that those experiences have on everyone else in that person's orbit. What happened after Anne's death? What happened to you as a friend and a caregiver? And was the hospice team able to help with that?
Yes. And I think I would be selling us short if I didn't share that in the last hours of her life, we did transport her to the Millen McClure Respite House. And that was by far one of the biggest gifts that I was able to receive as her friend and caregiver, because I didn't have to be vigil at her bedside as a caregiver. I could be her best friend in a room where there were already caregivers who could come in. And so that was a huge relief for me. She was so stubborn, but she also knew we were going to have her go there because she was in a lot of pain. And she was only there for 6 or so hours. She died on the day of the eclipse. She was very dramatic like that, I like to say. It was a very special experience, even though it was short. And that meant a lot to me. That meant everything to me. If I could have written a script for how it could have been for me to feel cared for in the hours of the end of her life, that was it. Like, I had space, I had people. It was so wonderful. And then after she passed, they do one of the most beautiful things. They do an honor walk in the building where they have a beautiful quilt that they lay over your loved one. It's just so full of incredible love. That's where I want to die. If I have that option, I will go there. The other thing that happened for me that I did not understand and realize would happen was about a couple weeks after she passed, I got a phone call from this really sweet man named Paul. And I initially, if you work for UVM Health, you know the 847-3000 number rings and you're like, oh, it's the health system. So I was like, who's calling me from work? And I answered and I was so thrown. He said, oh, I'm Paul. I'm from Home Health and Hospice. I'm a bereavement counselor. And he said, do you want to talk? Do you want some support? And I was so thrown. I was like, no, I'm fine. Okay, send me your packet. I didn't know how to respond. And so he sent me this email. And for anyone that doesn't know, if your family member is in hospice in our system, you're basically adopted for a year. Like, all of these services are made available to you, bereavement counseling, groups, all these things that I had no idea. And maybe someone told me about it, but I didn't realize it until after. And I availed myself of that. And I felt like it was a gift. It felt like a second gift, you know, of being able to be there for Anne and then having her death give me the ability to take care of myself and work through my grief with someone else that was a professional and yet was tied to the organization where she had been cared for. And I met with him at the respite house, which was also really helpful for me and really special. I felt really cared for. It really changed my grief experience.
Christy, thanks for sharing these powerful experiences and your story. It's really a message of hope and agency, which is my favorite kind of story to share with folks as we explore these really challenging moments that everybody goes through. It's time for a quick break. When Living Healthy Together comes back, we'll sit down with two members of the hospice team, a bereavement counselor and a social worker, who will share their own insights and experiences. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're talking about hospice care, at-home care, and the impact that end-of-life conversations and experiences have, not just on the people that are going through them, but everyone in their orbit. We're joined now by Jeannie Sullivan, a bereavement counselor and licensed clinical social worker, and Ezra Leibowitz, a hospice medical social worker. Both Jeannie and Ezra are part of the care team at Home Health and Hospice. What is the experience like working almost exclusively with patients and families who are going through the end-of-life process? It's scary, it's big, and it's something that everyone will ultimately experience in their lives.
For me, it is an honor to be with people at this time, this very vulnerable and difficult period in their life, saying goodbye to a loved one and then supporting them moving forward. I love my job.
It's pretty grounding. It's incredibly rewarding in the sense that I get to sit with a really difficult thing every single day. And in addition to helping my patients and their families through this incredibly challenging, emotional, complex process, I get to learn a lot about myself, and I get to learn about my fears, my concerns, and kind of sit with that. So it's a give and take. I'm really lucky to be able to do it every day.
What are the things that you see cropping up as really challenging or really negative for people that a little bit more preparation or a change in perspective could address?
We're talking about hospice, and just the word itself is got a lot of weight to it. It's a scary word. It's a heavy word. It's a word that most people equate with death, just period, end of sentence. And I'd love for there to be a reframe of that. I'd love for there to be a societal, cultural understanding that hospice is not death. Hospice is a part of the end of life journey, a part of the life journey. Societally, we don't talk about death. We don't prepare for death. We don't prepare for end of life. We don't prepare for a broken arm, right? We don't prepare for cancer. But when we have those things, when those experiences come into our life, we seek experts. We seek people who are prepared for that to help guide us through that, to help mend our bones, to help cure our cancer, whatever the issue is. And hospice is no different. Hospice is helping people through that part of their life that at times is really hard. And we're here to help make it less hard, make it more comfortable. And I'd love for there to be more conversation about end of life in general so that people aren't as fearful of it. It's always going to be scary. The unknown's always scary. But knowing that there's people there to help you through it who are familiar with what it looks like leading up to it, I think can help change the perspective.
Also, the practical things, hospice coming in, talking about doing an advance directive. It's very helpful to the family if the person has ideas about funeral planning and what they want. Also, having a will, all of that stuff gets really complicated once the person dies. And people are in a very heightened emotional state and trying to figure all this out.
And I wonder whether what you're talking about here might emerge as an easier on-ramp into these conversations for folks. I know when I've started thinking about this or trying to talk about it with my family and my parents, it's an emotional thing.
Yes.
And that feels super overwhelming and really hard to deal with. And you don't even know if you can deal with it, right? That's going to change my entire world. And that becomes really unwieldy.
You don't need to be 50 or 60 or whatever to do an advance directive. An advance directive is a document that changes over time, depending on your age and what your goals of care are. So to make it easy to talk about, it's for everyone.
And they really do serve as an on-ramp. Again, these are hard conversations. That's just a fact of end of life. And preparing for it is challenging, one, time-wise, right? Who's got time to go sit with an attorney for a will or really pour their heart into an advanced directive and sit there for an hour and think about these hard things? I've been doing this for 6 years, and I've been in the field of working with people and helping with advanced directives for 10-plus years, but it wasn't until I had my son 4 years ago that I finally practiced what I preached and did one myself. It took me until I was 31 to do it, but I had been telling people, this is so important. You got to do it. You got to do it. We're all human. It doesn't have to happen today. But these tools, these really concrete pieces that we have access to, can be the onboard to this conversation. And then in the future, when we get to the place where we really are facing end of life, you've given this guideline, you've given this outline to help the people, whether it's your children or your other family members, to help make those decisions easier so there's less stress on them. There's less weight that they have to carry if they do have to make those super hard decisions.
Jeannie, can you talk about the grieving process? Talk a little bit about what folks need to understand before they go through it.
It is very individualized, but there are definite themes around grieving. And that initial, what we call raw grief in the beginning, it's chaotic. You're in a fog. It's deeply painful. It's surreal. So people need a lot of support, and people often, friends and people in that orbit, often don't know what to do to support a grieving person. So they may shy away from it and feel like, oh, I don't want to bother that person. They're so busy. They have so much to do. I really encourage you to reach out. And it can be something so simple like sending a text, I'm thinking about you, or a phone call. The question of how can I help? What can I do? That's a difficult one. People in that state don't really know what they need. So, you know, bringing over a meal, asking, do you want to take a walk? Sitting with a person and just being and listening. Those all can be really helpful. What are you thinking about, Ezra?
It's hard to prepare. It's hard to prepare for death. It's hard to prepare for grief. Part of it is the support when somebody comes onto hospice, but to the part of bereavement, you have access to it for 13 months. And you have access for 13 months because grief's not linear. I tell people this all the time. Hey, you've got this support, this number that you can call after your loved one dies. They're going to reach out to you in a few weeks just to say, hey, how you doing? Here's our number if you need us. But if you don't call them for 6 months, that's totally fine. If you feel like you are going through life and things are going okay after your loved one dies, and in 6 months something hits you like a rock and you are crumbling, that's normal. That's how grief works. It creeps up. It hits you when you least expect it. Sometimes it doesn't make any sense at all, but that's why the support is there. So it really is this very all-encompassing care and support through death and then after the fact as well. The rebuild of the Respite House in 2018 as Vermont's only dedicated inpatient hospice facility really helped to say hospice and end of life can be beautiful. It can be fulfilling. It can be this glorious bookend to a life. And all of these things help to create that. While this is scary, there are people that are here to help you through this to make it less scary, to make it less of an unknown. And it doesn't need to be something that we reach for when there are no other options. It can be something that we can do proactively. We can be informed. We can be engaged. We can seek the information ourselves. We try to make all that info available to people. For those that have any questions or might be experiencing this as well, just call us. Not only are we happy to talk about it, but the threshold for us going out to have a meeting with someone, even if it's just exploratory, is pretty low. We're here to educate the community. So accessing us, getting in touch with us is really easy. You just got to pick up the phone and someone will pick up.
Really important, positive, action-oriented way to close out the episode. I always love giving people something that they can do, a way to help themselves out and help their loved ones. We'll link the home health and hospice resources and contact information in the episode description. So if you're listening to this as a podcast, check out the description for those resources. That's all the time we have today on Living Healthy Together. Thank you, Jeannie, Ezra. Thanks to all of our guests for their stories, their insight. I'm your host, Philip Rao. We'll see you next time.